Take a network break. Grab a big bowl of Halloween candy and join us for our weekly review of tech news. We've got stories on Amazon, Cisco, Qualcomm, and more. I'm Drew Conry Murray, and with me is Greg Farrow. This episode of Network Break is being brought to you by IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV is an easy, entertaining approach to online IT training. For a free 7-day trial, go to itpro.tv/networkbreak and use the code NETWORKBREAK30. And also thanks to Nuage Networks. Let Nuage Networks make your data center network as responsive as your business needs to be. Find out how their software-defined networking solutions will transform your data center network so it can keep pace with your business. Visit nuagenetworks.net and join the cloud conversation on Twitter using @NuageNetworks. All right, let's start with updates from the Dyn DDoS attack. More information has been coming in about how it all went down and who was responsible. Various sources have confirmed the use of IoT devices such as security cameras and DVRs. They're part of a big Mirai botnet that were used in the attack. One manufacturer in particular has been implicated. It's a Chinese company called Xiaomi. They're actually recalling 10,000 webcams, which may have been compromised.
Yeah, well, we all saw some problems this week. I thought when I was watching it start, I thought maybe level 3 backbone had another outage. That was the original scuttlebutt. And for those of us who watch the internet, level 3 has been having a very bad time. And then it turned out that, of course, that Dyn DNS was actually under attack. And it was a DNS failure because most of Dyn's hosting was on level 3, and maybe even most of the mitigation for the attack was eventually in level 3. It looked like level 3, but it turned out to be Dyn DNS that was in trouble here.
That's right.
So it sort of was intermittent at first, and then it degraded. And then there are companies out there who so very big names like Twitter, for example.
Yes,
who
Reddit, New York Times.
Yeah, some pretty well-known websites. So everything went out and people got very excited. So as you say, this appears to be associated with the Mirai botnet. If you look into the details behind the Mirai botnet, I'm sure most of you have already, but let me try and summarize it. The Mirai botnet is basically, it's not actually a botnet. Somebody used it a couple of weeks ago to do some attacks. And then they released the code. So now anybody can actually build their own Mirai botnet. It's right. Quite open, easy to get, not hard to find. And what it basically does is it uses a database of well-known logins. So that is default admin username password type sequences to be able to get onto devices and then tell those devices to create traffic by doing a DNS lookup to try and get to a web page basically. And if you are hosting the DNS services and you've got a vast number of devices, you can overload them. So the Miro botnet, with an appropriate amount of time and energy spent, can easily build up 10 million devices. So of which apparently the worst offender appears to be the Xiaomi company out of China, who have been making webcams and for everybody else to slap a brand name on. It's a bit like a lot of the older, like Hoover washing machines and vacuum cleaners. The company Hoover went out of business 20 years ago. But you can rent the name and make a washing machine out of it if you want.
Right. Yes. They're, I guess, sort of a white brand. Other people take their product, put their name on it, and maybe add some more things to it. But apparently they did have a well-known hard-coded password on these devices, and attackers were able to either telnet or SSH in, take over the systems, install the malware, and then, hey, you've got a nice little cannon to direct at people.
That's right. When it's all automated, right? So the system, you can just go in there and say, attack this site. And lo and behold, it would go out. Your master server would then go out and connect to all these devices and do a lookup. And it was literally just the DNS lookup, which was taking down Dyn DNS. It was just so many single endpoints doing a DNS lookup that Dyn DNS collapsed under the load.
So one other thing that came out in this analysis is everyone was like, who's doing this? What's going on? Is this a state attack? Is this cyber criminals? There's a research company called Flashpoint. They're suggesting that the attack was actually launched by amateurs or so-called script kiddies, not a state actor or criminals.
Yeah, there was some suggestion. Dyn DNS isn't really talking. We haven't seen much from them about the attack. They've just said, something's broken and we're working hard to get to the root of it. So I was at the Open Networking User Group and I was listening to somebody and they were saying that the conference was happening last week. There was a NANOG event, which is an ISP, and Dyn was up on stage sort of suggesting that their product was unassailable or whatever. And he suggested that maybe somebody took that at their word and decided to give him a go.
Oh, dear. never bring that curse down upon yourself.
Yeah, so there's no evidence to suggest that's actually true, but, you know, who knows? Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. I'm not 100% sure. So we'll see. So I guess, you know, I think it was likely to be Script Kiddies. This botnet was really easy to set up. Anybody could download the code, and we're likely to see more attacks. The scuttlebutt that I saw was that somebody said that the DNS name was a video game company. I quote, unquote, I'm not sure what difference is between a game and a video game, and that DNS was hosting it, and so everybody else was just collateral damage. If that's true, then yes, Script Kiddies were probably looking to take down their favorite game server as a, you know,
as a prank finger, or, yeah.
As a prank or some sort of misguided sort of sense of justice because they stole my $20 or something. Well, we'll see. So, you know, it's not 100% clear what will happen. It sure is a sign that the internet – I've seen articles suggesting that the shows that the internet is robust as you can possibly imagine to just how bad the internet is in terms of reliability.
I guess there are, depending on your perspective, different ways to look at it. It's certainly – I mean, the amount of attention that it caught, though, is these kind of security things, these a little bit more obscure security issues don't always reach the public press. But I guess because people's favorite websites went out, you know, suddenly everybody wants to talk about it.
I think it's I think this might be, as a DDoS attack, it might be the most comprehensible one in the sense that it's very easy to – for somebody who's got a liberal arts degree to write a story that makes coherent sense. I note, however, that none of them have actually summed up any lessons that they've learned. So let me give you some of my own. There's four of them here, so let's just go through these. So first of all, own your domain registration. Don't rely on a third party to change the root delegation. So literally, if you own a domain name, make sure you own – you have direct access to the company that that the domain is registered with. So, for example, in my case, I use hover.com. Although my domain name might be hosted by my – might be running at a DNS provider somewhere else, I could actually go to my domain registration and change the root server. So, for example, a lot of companies actually outsource, you know, their whole domain thing. Mm-hmm. And so if you are, you know, companya.com, they just go and look after all of that. And, of course, now you have to ring up, lodge a service request, and get the delegation changed from Dyn DNS to a competitor. Mm-hmm. So the way to fix this, of course, is to say, well, why am I using Dyn DNS? It's under attack. I'll switch to another company that's not under attack. And, of course, if you don't own the domain registration, you're kind of screwed. You can't change it.
Right.
So the ability here is to say you should not have a single supplier for domain services. So your root registration shouldn't just point to Dyn DNS. It should point to any one of the other DNS providers. So you should have, if you are a high volume company, it would be foolish to think having a single supplier won't cause a single point of failure.
Sure, it's a belt and suspenders kind of idea. Instead of just having one DNS infrastructure provider, you set it up with one or two or maybe even three and spread the load around. Yeah.
Yeah. Now there is a natural negative here, right? Operationally, this gets very difficult.
Sure, it does make your life more complicated.
Because now you're looking at, you know, running two DNS providers, and every time you make changes, you have to do it to two places. And that makes automation harder. That makes operating it harder. But, you know, if you are running a $10 billion business, it's about time you manned up and, you know, started some high-class adulting around your IT infrastructure. This also, of course, means that your purchasing department is also, you know, without a doubt, they're not your friend in IT. Your purchasing department is probably your worst vendor. They always say, "Oh, I don't want to run multiple accounts with multiple vendors," and you know why? I want to reduce the number of suppliers on our books and blah blah blah. And you probably did this just to shut them up, and now you're going to have to start doing that. So that's a bit of a problem.
Okay, so you have to get security and finance to talk to each other and hash that out.
Yeah, I mean it's not acceptable, and I think. You know, I've been talking about multi-vendor for everything. I think it's no longer acceptable to have a single supplier for anything. And this highlights two sides of the debate. You know, sure, it's harder to run multiple suppliers and it can be more complex internally. And, you know, but when the single supplier fails you, what are you going to do? Go through a 6-month evaluation process for a competitor? You know, like, yeah. No, you know, adult behavior is what's needed in IT. And we've got to get away from this really. I could simplify this if I only dealt with one vendor. Yes, you might solve your problem in the next 4 weeks, but you've just opened up a whole bunch of butthurt that you just aren't thinking. And that's
right.
Yeah. Again, lack of competency is and long-term thinking is a problem. So the one other thing, too, is that those of you who set your DNS settings are often asked to set the cache timeouts. So the natural thing is to set your cache timeouts reasonably long So that what happens is the way that a DNS lookup is the client does a DNS lookup, and the DNS servers in the middle will then look to the root, and the root will come back and say, yes, this is the mapping from the name to the IP address, and this is how long the root record should be held in your cache. One of the problems, of course, here is that even if you could switch away from Dyn DNS, you had to wait for the cache interval to expire. Mm. And some people have 12, 24 hours, 36 hours, 72-hour cache intervals. Mm. And if I've done a lookup and it's going to sit in the cache for 2 or 3 days before the root server does another look forward, I'm kind of not going to help you. Now, of course, you might think to yourself, well, I'll just reduce the cache timeout down to 30 minutes. And now, of course, you've just increased the hell load on your authoritative servers to something phenomenal. And you've also increased the bandwidth load on your servers, and there's usually a cost associated with the number of DNS records that you're expected to have. So, hey, you've got a problem. So don't run around reducing your cache time to allowing you to switch suppliers faster without understanding that it's going to increase your load on your authoritative servers, and it may actually cost you a lot more money. The final thing I want you to understand is, understand that DDoS mitigation takes hours to have effect. So Dyn DNS had a DDoS strategy, a mitigation strategy. They had it in place. They invoked it pretty quickly, as far as I can tell, within an hour or two of the attack happening, and it still took 12 hours for them to get the mitigation under control. I wonder how many of you who have a DDoS service have ever sort of got your so-called leaders or managers or executives who are highly paid to understand these issues and communicate them to the business and explain that DDoS mitigation, you don't just go and click a button and it happens. They actually have to profile the traffic, examine it, and then start to build rules that will then mitigate it.
Right.
Right? So it takes many hours for these DDoS mitigations to cover up, right? And it's not like you have a choice here, because if you don't, it was broken before you started fixing it, and if you don't fix it, it'll still be broken. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people don't understand this in their DDoS strategies, that mitigation takes hours to have effect. So lots of lessons to be learned. One final thing is, don't be tempted to run your own host your own DNS. You just can't do it. You probably can't afford the DDoS mitigation. You probably can't afford the traffic bandwidth, and you probably can't afford to run that many DNS servers. This is, in many senses, an exceptional circumstance. And you know what might be happening, Drew? We might actually see the internet do something about preventing this, because this could have been prevented by a bunch of, you know, reasonably good ISP behaviors. And we haven't.
Well, it seems like there's a lot of parts here. Obviously, the ISPs have something to do with it. Looking at legitimate and illegitimate traffic, device manufacturers have a lot to do with it in making their systems a little bit harder to get access to. So a lot of moving parts. But I do think something like this, when it reaches the general public's attention, folks start saying, all right, we got to take this seriously.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's always going to be interesting to see how these things come out, but it's really up to the ISPs to start protecting their own businesses. There are a number of things that could be done, like BCP 38, for example, or whatever, and many of them just don't, because they don't add to the bottom line. They are operationally complex.
Sure.
And they just say, next year when we've got nothing better to do, and guess what? Quite honestly, I'd rather take a holiday than implement some of these changes.
Well, if this kind of thing keeps happening and it's not, an occasional major outage, then maybe we will see some action. But you're right. Who knows? All right. Let's move on, because we've done that to death. I got a story about Qualcomm. They are announcing their intention to buy NXP Semiconductors for $38 billion. $38 billion. Why are they so interested? NXP has 14% of the market for the chips that are used in automobiles, plus an IoT business. As we've seen, mobile device sales begin to plateau. Companies are looking toward cars and other devices as kind of the next growth platform. So Qualcomm's buying its way in here.
Well, I actually read different articles to you on this one, Drew. You're talking about... You said cars and what was it?
IoT.
Cars and IoT?
Yeah.
The one that I heard is that NXP actually supplies a bunch of chips to Apple in iPhone. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And mm-hmm. So they were all going gung-ho because of the Apple. And I find the short answer, of course, is if you're paying $38 billion for a company, it's not doing any one of those things. It's doing all of those
things. Sure. Yes. Oh, it's not to say that there's no money in mobile devices. Absolutely. But if you're looking at straight pure growth, I do anticipate, as we see more effort around self-driving cars and more automation coming to cars and more technology services being put into cars, that that's going to be a booming industry. The car is going to become the essential ultimate mobile device.
Well, this is also a reaction to the merger of Avago and Broadcom, who were two of the biggest manufacturers of silicon.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're seeing here is that Qualcomm's reacting to that. So as Broadcom Avago merges and gets bigger, then Qualcomm has to acquire to get to the same scale and compete on an equal footing. So it's not even, you know, Qualcomm in the past has always wanted to beat its own road forward. It's been a difficult company to be a partner of. And so now it's probably being forced into this because Broadcom was bought by Avago and they have scale. So it's not like, you know, there's many things going on. Like any big purchase, $38 billion, there's a lot of things, a lot of wheels, a lot of juggling going on.
Sure, sure.
There's many, many different stories in here, I think.
All right, and now we'll switch to Cisco. They've announced a new service to tackle the pirating of streamed video. It's called, as you might guess, the Streaming Piracy Prevention Service. It uses a watermarking system so they can identify and automatically shut down pirated streams. I think they're probably going particularly after live events like sports, which you know, can be easily pirated and folks don't want to have to pay cable for it.
Yeah, it's funny how ISPs can't block DDoS attacks, but they can block piracy.
Well, they know where their bread is buttered.
Isn't it funny? So what Cisco's doing here is actually using some cloud services to tag traffics and to build up a collection of libraries so that they can recognize these things, as it says, to build up a database of watermarks. And then what you do is you, in your devices in the network, you can start scanning for pirated videos that are being streamed across the network. Now, there's a number of sites across the internet that actually have pirate streams that people can look at. I'm not totally familiar with them, but I've heard about them at various times. What concerns me here is, A, Cisco's getting back into putting services inside the network. So no doubt this is a reaction to customers saying, dear Cisco, we need a solution for blocking pirated content, maybe, sort of. Because up until now, the carriers have just said, we can't block it. All we can do is maybe give you some IP addresses of where it is.
Right.
So Cisco's going after this, and what they're really doing here is relying on the government to give them a business model.
Because, you think so?
Yeah, pretty much. Because the government will have to say, copyright is a breach. We need to be able to prosecute this. When the ISPs say, well, we can't block traffic, you know, detect movies, it's all just IP, they're going to point to this and say, well, you have to implement one of these, and all of a sudden Cisco's in the money.
Mm, interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Which is kind of detestable, although, you know, in a good capitalist society, wherever there's money, there's a product and a solution. So yay them. But what I'm more concerned about is that this is also effectively a state or a nationwide scale for censorship. Anything that blocks censorship, it's very easy to build a database of watermarks for video, but now let's turn it into anything else like websites to block or stuff like that. Once you've got the blocking tools in the network, anybody else can do that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, the censorship issue is very tricky. And in a related story, Forbes reported earlier this week on an engineer who resigned from a company called Procera. They make deep packet inspection technology. And this person resigned because I guess the company was going to sell some technology to a Turkish telecom. They were worried that the deep inspection technology, and particularly a feature that lets them pull passwords and usernames out of unencrypted traffic, would be used for state-sponsored surveillance and possibly repression.
Yes, almost definitely. But this streaming, you know, that's what they're for. I mean, sure. You know, Blue Code proxy servers, Gigamon network taps are all, you know, well-known, well-publicized types. You know, all network monitoring technology can be used for good or for ill.
That's right.
But this is actually quite a bit different because Cisco could be in a unique situation of saying, you know, we have a cloud service that owns the water, can build these watermarks of content that needs to be blocked.
Mm-hmm.
And if the government goes to them and says, we want this content to be blocked, Cisco could be forced to add that to their database.
Sure.
Because and it would maybe be legal. Right.
And maybe the content is not a live sporting event. Maybe it's, you know, some kind of training material on human rights techniques or whatever, or messages that this government may not agree with. So, yeah.
Well, think about Turkey totally when Turkey had that uprising recently where,
yes.
You know, and the military coup put a video out announcing that, you know, we are having blah, blah, blah. And so if the legal government goes to Cisco and says, we want this blocked, what do they do?
Right.
Okay, so now you're into a very dodgy. So, you know, on one hand, I want to say, you know, Cisco is giving customers what they want. Good for Cisco. On the other hand, Cisco is probably enabling a technology which is bad for society overall. But we shouldn't be surprised that Cisco just wants the money.
Well, and I don't think it's fair to point out just Cisco. Every company that's working on the network that has some kind of a feature that could be used for security or intellectual property protection can also be misused.
Mm-hmm. Tough one.
It's a different one, yeah.
And what's your moral position? If you're working for a company that can do this, what do you think? Whether it's the vendor or the customer or the reseller that sells this and deploys this. I wonder, we've had this discussion before, so let's move on. We'll just leave it at that.
All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break to tell you about IT Pro TV. With IT Pro TV, you gain access to the most important tools you need to prepare for your IT certification. And Greg, you want to tell us a little bit more about it?
Sure. IT Pro TV is, of course, thousands of hours of high-quality video content, and more than 30 hours of it is being added weekly. So it's actually being refreshed and coming on. Courses are streamed live and on demand, so you can watch them on your favorite thing, be it your favorite computer, maybe an Apple TV, or even on your favorite mobile device while you're in the toilet. I mean, let's face it, everybody does a little bit of that. Maybe you don't.
We'll leave that there.
There's quite a wide range of course topics, with more being added every week. Now, latest ones are networking with Windows Server 2016, CCNA, RNS, Microsoft Servers, MCSEs, Red Hat Linux, and much, much more. And don't forget that there is an enterprise account if you are signed up. And so if you are signed up with an enterprise account with a competitor, IT Pro TV will match your previous year's pricing of that account, so you can transfer it over, maybe even keep the budget a bit under control.
All right, so check out itprotv.com/networkbreak to upgrade your brain with the most popular IT certifications. Premium subscriptions are normally $57 a month or $570 a year, but there's a special offer. You can try it free for 7 days when you sign up using the code NETWORKBREAK30, and you also get 30% off the lifetime of your account, so that comes to less than $40 a month. So thanks, IT Pro TV, for being a sponsor. Okay, back to the news. A week after Amazon and VMware announced a hybrid cloud plan, Amazon has released a tool designed to help companies migrate applications from the data center into Amazon's cloud. It's called Server Migration Service. The tool starts with VMware virtual machines, but according to Amazon, it should work with other hypervisors and bare metal servers in the future.
Yeah, so remember a couple of weeks ago, I talked about Amazon and private cloud. Amazon has to do something to make sure that private cloud gets into AWS. They're going to have to find ways to... Because otherwise people, the barrier to jumping is too high. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, look what they're doing. They're fine. So definitely they were listening to everything I say.
Of course. Absolutely. Why not?
No, a product like this would have been in development for many years, probably a couple at least. And this is the way that Amazon is going to be able to spin loads from private clouds into public clouds. And the question here really is for me is, what's the vice versa? If I've got an instance in the AWS, how do I get it back into my VMware ESX hypervisor? So it's very interesting that VMware is going to put their software-defined data center in that AWS, and then Amazon launches a tool which can suck you straight out into an ES instance.
That's right.
That gives a very difficult competitive situation and reduces the barrier to entry.
I mean, yeah, I was thinking about this, that it seems a little bit... I don't want to say sneaky, but certainly I'm sure VMware wasn't thrilled about the release of this tool, but they're also kind of over a barrel. And so by having their relationship on hybrid cloud with Amazon, they still get a little piece of the action, even as they see workloads moving into Amazon.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So workloads moving into Amazon makes it easier. If you think this is a great idea, just make sure you always ask yourself, how do I get them back out?
Like, that's a good question.
Right? Because that's your job as a network as a architect in the enterprise, is not so much how great it would be to buy this product and then suddenly realize all of the problems and the weaknesses. Think about all the things that could go wrong up front. And my one is, fine, bring your service into AWS. How much is it going to cost? You'll never know, because it's all based on consumption. How much will it operate? Don't know. But more importantly, if the costs don't work out the way I want, how the hell do I get it back out? So how do you take an AWS instance, an EC2 instance, and migrate it back to my software-defined data center in the private cloud?
Well, based on my understanding, it's not going to be removed from your own private cloud data center. It's simply just replicating that instance. So it's a copy that lives in AWS. So you won't be losing the copy that's on your site. You'll still have it. You can still play with it.
Oh, yes. That's the way VM migrations work today.
Yeah.
But, as soon as it starts running in AWS, it's different from the one that you've saved, in some way. So now you've got a problem. So,
well, I think the issue becomes one of if you're starting to use the AWS version and data is being gathered there, user data, consumer data, whatever, then the issue becomes how do I bring it back? How do I get it all integrated? So Amazon's goal here is to make it very easy to get you into the cloud. They don't talk very much at all about getting you back out because that's not in their interest.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So like, be aware.
Like, yeah, you can always transfer data into AWS for free, but getting it out.
That's right. That's why they set up that model that way.
That's right, yeah.
They know what they're doing. Mm. All right, sticking with cloud services, Arm, who's best known for licensing chip designs for processors that power smartphones and tablets, they're launching their own cloud service, and this is aimed at IoT producers. The service is called Embed Cloud, and it's offering provisioning and management of IoT devices. According to a story by Stacey Higginbotham, Arm anticipates that the service will be, quote, a significant source of revenue, unquote, although they didn't say how significant.
It's getting easy to build clouds, isn't it?
I guess it is, yes.
Everybody tells me that AWS has got this amazing edge and, you know, so advanced and nobody can ever compete. And yet you look around and you go like, actually, you know, people are buying a lot of cloud, have already built a lot of clouds, and there's going to be a lot more. So,
well, it sounds like the article doesn't say whether Arm is building out its own cloud infrastructure. My impression is they're using an existing cloud provider. They didn't say who, though, so maybe it is AWS. I don't know.
Well, it could be, you know, if you start out with a product and there's a 1 in 5 chance that this product will make it.
Right.
Remember? So statistically, 1 in 5 products that are announced, only, you know, they're the only ones that make any sense going that actually succeed going forward. So sure, it may be initially hosted by an undisclosed cloud provider, but the goal would be is to build your own if there's actually revenue and stuff out of this, because that's the only way to capture all the revenue.
Sure.
That makes these things scale. And, you know, we've already seen Cisco buy Jasper. There's a half a dozen other IoT platforms out there.
Yep.
You need to be a big company with deep pockets to build out those things and then go and chase after the customers so that, you know, in the same way that, you know, Apple iPhones, you've got a bunch of apps. It's really easy to write an app once you've got a higher performance phone and an operating system and iCloud and an app store. Do you know what I mean?
Sure. Yeah, no, it's the platform effect. Yeah.
That's the platform effect. So if you're going to build a platform at that sort of scale, you can't be a small business. You have to be a mega company. And Arm, and keep in mind that Arm was taken over by SoftBank. They've got access to really big funds now to be able to do these types of things. It makes perfect sense, I think.
Yep. They do have a lot of competition, though. AWS does have its own IoT platform. Azure does. And recently, Microsoft and GE partnered around GE's Predix, which is a PaaS offering for industrial applications and IoT, and then Predix will run in Azure as well. So Arm definitely has its work cut out for it.
Oh, Predix is lined up with everybody. Cisco, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Shopping it around.
Yeah, we don't stand for anybody. We stand for all solutions.
We stand for all the money.
Yeah, we stand for whatever money we can grab from whoever. Yeah.
That's right. All right, a little note about Google. They are pausing the rollout of new fiber connections in the United States. Google Fiber is going to continue to operate in cities where it's currently available or work is already underway, but any further expansion has been halted. In addition, the CEO of Google Access, which is the unit that runs the fiber business, is stepping down and some employees are being laid off.
Not surprising. I think I said this 4 or 5 weeks ago from memory that it wouldn't be surprising if Google pulls back from fiber because of 5G. I don't think this is particularly because of Google getting tired of throwing money out. I think there's a technology issue in here.
Mm-hmm.
So we've seen a stream of articles where Google Core wasn't able to get access to poles to hang fiber, or
they
weren't able to lay fiber in the ground because, you know, extensive legal rules. We've heard some success stories where the local government can totally get behind Google and it hasn't been blocked by the incumbent telco. So we've also seen legal cases from, you know, the carriers, you know, AT&T and Comcast to block restrict access to ducts and right-of-way, and we've seen union objections in some towns and planning permission blocked by local councils after they were lobbied by telcos. In other words, you know, here's a little bung to get your for your voting campaign. Now, let us tell you about what we want, what about our protecting our business, and you know, what it means to you.
That
sort of stuff. So where we've seen local governments give unequivocal support and the local government didn't have counter-cyclical agreements with the incumbent telcos, like, you know, signed agreements with AT&T and Comcast to give them privileged access to, you know, civic infrastructure, Google has actually delivered fiber cheaply and on time. I think ultimately 5G is going to make much more sense. All you have to do is put up a pole with some power, use some unlicensed spectrum and start delivering broadband across that. That is going to be relatively fast, a hell of a lot less effort. and you know, something that's just going to make a significant dent in, say, 10 to 20 years as opposed to the Google Fiber.
Yeah, I sure hope so, because I would love to see more local competition for internet access. We've got essentially mini monopolies in the United States. So if Google Fiber is pulling out just because fiber is too hard to roll out and they're going to go with a wireless solution, that I have no problem with that.
Well, keep in mind with 5G, you can put up a base station and then start a long-term plan to get fiber to it for more bandwidth, but you can build a mesh out of the ones that you've got. So you can get a business running without having to dig the fiber in, but then dig the fiber in, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years later without affecting your revenue stream. And you know, in Google's case, having the impact that you want. So I think this makes much more sense. Get into 5G, put that down, build up a footprint in the area while you start the legal, you know, start solving the fiber to the ground problem. And then you've only got to run fiber to the 5G base stations. You don't have to run it to every house.
Right. Exactly.
So that changes the game.
It does. Yeah, simplifies the problem a little bit.
Yep, sure.
It's also interesting to see that Google, which has just been sort of throwing money at all kinds of pie-in-the-sky projects, is starting to pull back a little bit and say, hey, I guess our ad revenue isn't infinite. Maybe we need to see some of these little side businesses start making some cash.
Any research and development department goes through excitement and then reality phases.
Right. And they have walked right into some reality.
I think so. And I also think that we're seeing much more complex engagement between Google and its R&D environment. So things that make sense long term, or they don't cost a lot, like, you know, the Google balloon thing, building internet with balloons. I imagine that costs next to nothing, you know, like 30 or 40 people building balloons and fancy gear or whatever.
Right.
But this Google Fiber is on a whole new scale, and it's got them, you know, engaged in dozens of towns in courts and legals and blah, blah, blah. Why wouldn't you just go, like, this ain't working, let's pull back and look, there's this technology coming down the pipe, we could go with that. And then, of course, your CEO is all built around that legacy business, you know, that having lawyers and arguing and telcos and lobbying, and the 5G is going to be all that different. Or maybe the CEO of that business just walked away when he realized he wasn't going to make his bonuses. Never underestimate the power of losing your bonus. You
know. Or maybe one of the incumbents made him a better offer. Who knows?
Yes, indeed.
All right, there's a new report from Gartner that predicts that global IT spending is going to hit $3.5 trillion with a T in 2017. That will be up 2.9% over 2016.
So, huzzah.
Huzzah, so, money.
Just, huzzah, lots of money, big numbers. I think a couple of things here. Global IT spending, I've never quite worked out what this global IT spend is. Does that mean everything? Smartphones, computers, corporate, retail, industrial?
I believe, I don't know about industrial, but I do know they broke it out by, so for instance, the biggest spending area is going to be in services. It's supposed to be $943 billion. They also tallied software spending. They're calling that at $357 billion. And then data center systems, communications, and devices, of which I do think include PCs, smartphones, that kind of thing. Yeah. So I think they're trying to make as big a bucket as they can with this number.
So really, public cloud's doing a lot to reduce the cost of IT, isn't it?
I guess so.
Oh,
yeah.
Sorry.
I mean, $943 billion on services is. Whew.
That's right. Yeah, but I mean, the whole lot is up 2.9%. I guess the question in my mind here is that, you know, you're talking, like, enterprises are expected to invest in inverted commas $177 billion in data center systems, which is an increase of 2%. So if public cloud is taking away all this business and blah blah blah, why is it still growing in the enterprise? This doesn't make sense. There's some narrative problem here where everybody believes that AWS and Google Cloud and Azure is sucking up all of the enterprise money, but it doesn't seem to be. Right? It's supposed to make it cheaper, not more expensive, isn't it?
Well, it's not supposed to necessarily make it cheaper, but it's supposed to make it easier to buy and less friction to operate.
Yep. So AWS did announce its numbers this week. It's making 3-point-something billion. I think I put a tweet out about it. Basically, $3.3 billion in the last quarter. Like, great money for a 10-year-old business.
Yes.
But small beer out of $177 billion overall. So even if, you know, if AWS is a $10 billion a year business, it's probably more like a $12 billion a year business, that makes it less than 10%, no, not even 5% of the overall data center spend in the enterprise.
So you're saying cloud predictions are a little bit off, that that there's still some spending going on in the data center?
Oh, yeah, but I just think it's hype. We need to separate out the hype from the reality.
Of course.
The hype is that AWS is the new hotness and the new coolness. The reality is that 97% of all spending is going on in the enterprise data center that we know today.
Although less than it used to be, because we are seeing companies like HPE, Cisco starting to struggle with these kind of sales. The growth isn't there like it used to be. There's still a lot of money, but it's not not a lot of growth.
Yep, but this is still saying that there's still a 2% increase. So,
well,
where's it going?
Yeah, that's true. Where's it going? All right, we are going to get to some financial news in the second half of the show, but I want to take a break to tell you about Nuage Networks. Organizations like yours are well on their way to taking full advantage of the cloud for ubiquitous agile connectivity across remote sites. But as your networks get bigger and more complex, a new challenge moves to the front line, and that is, of course, security. If protecting your sensitive data and key applications in a multi-tenant cloud is keeping you up at night, talk to the experts at Nuage Networks. They'll tell you how to provide a secure, multi-tenant environment and still roll out new services at the pace users demand. They'll show you a solution that's flexible as it is robust, and one that supports the particular policy-based requirements of different traffic while providing for elastic scale-out of additional security services as new capacity comes online. With a secure, software-defined networking solution from Nuage Networks, you'll have the most trusted cloud services available, so you can speed up your cloud deployments and deliver new services on demand, all with peace of mind. So please visit nuagenetworks.net to find out more, and you can join the cloud conversation on Twitter using @NuageNetworks, and we thank Nuage for being a sponsor. Okay, we did promise some financial news. We'll start with Juniper. They reported their Q3 financials. They posted a 3% revenue gain of $1.29 billion for the quarter. Unfortunately, income was down $172 million this quarter versus $197 million at this time last year.
Yeah, but a really exciting result, because Juniper had been sort of, their share price was down quite substantially. Straight after these announcements went, their price popped from $23 to $26 and has stayed stable for the last 20 couple of days. Basically, they're actually seeing some growth.
3% revenue gain is not bad.
Yeah, well, compared to like a 5-7% loss that we've seen for previous quarters.
Yeah.
I think what the market is particularly excited about is that they feel that Juniper's QFX switches, the 2FX10000, has actually achieved some sales in some cloud providers. And maybe that's an exciting thing to happen. So let's just wait and see. We've seen very mixed results from Juniper over the last, year. So, for example, the beginning of the year, say a year from today, their share price was $30. It was $22, and now it's $26. So it's been a bit all over the place. I think Juniper, most of the analysts are saying Juniper's turned a corner. I think Juniper's got some more to go, but well done on a great quarter. Here's hoping they've got another one coming.
Yeah, and they're estimating that their cloud revenue is going to account for almost a quarter of the business over the next 3 years. So looking to the cloud providers to grow.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? I wouldn't have picked the QFX for cloud providers.
No, I wouldn't either. But
maybe it's for the mid-tier, like the smaller cloud providers, not the majors.
Could be. All right, we also mentioned Amazon earlier. They reported their third quarter earnings. In fact, they missed their analyst expectations. Wall Street was expecting 78 cents a share, but actual numbers came in at 52 cents a share. So Amazon stocks fell on the news. However, that's the retail side of the business. Amazon Web Services is continuing to shine. As we mentioned, they posted revenue of $3.23 billion, which is up 55%. Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
And Jeff Bezos, the CEO, he's anticipating that AWS is going to be a $10 billion business for all of 2016.
Well, if they can do $3.23 billion in one quarter and increase sales by 55% in one quarter, then, this business is really growing. So in spite of what I said earlier, like AWS is actually still a relatively small fry in terms of total revenue compared to enterprise IT. 55% sales, if they can double that down again the next quarter, you're on a J-curve to like taking over stuff.
Yeah, there's an analyst who predicted that AWS will account for half of all Amazon's earnings in the next couple of years. That's how big this business could get.
A book company turns into a computer.
amazing.
An enterprise IT infrastructure. We just had to sell books to get there first. I don't know. I think ultimately, you could take there are people taking the view that there's nothing stopping AWS from taking up all the IT in all the world. I'm a little bit more cynical. I think there's significant headwinds in the business. They're creating a market which solving a customer need for, low cost, high cost but easy to consume services.
Right.
And that at some point there'll be a reckoning that'll come out as competition, and eventually at some point, surely, HP, Cisco, HDS, IBM has to start finding a way to react to Amazon and to take on AWS by producing decent quality private clouds. We haven't seen it yet. As I said last week with VMware's partnership with AWS, I would imagine it's partly a reaction to the fact that you still can't easily buy a private cloud for your own data center. You still have to go through months of negotiations and waffly details and blah, blah, blah. You can't just go and, I want a private cloud, drop a purchase order for a big number, and boom, you've got a private cloud.
Yeah, my feeling is that once people are in the cloud and they've been in the cloud for a while, and then once we finally get a good private cloud solution that makes it as easy or nearly as easy as it is to work with an Amazon or an Azure, you're going to see folks wanting to migrate back because those cloud costs are really going to add up and they're going to say, why am I spending all this money when I could have it back on my own premises? But we need to wait for the private cloud market to catch up to the ease with which you can deploy in the public cloud and write apps and get all those good features.
So speaking of turnarounds, Violin Memory didn't manage a turnaround and it's been halted by the New York Stock Exchange. So Violin Memory was one of the earliest SSD or flash storage companies. For the last couple of years, it's been beset with poor management. I only know of Violin Memory in passing, mainly by talking to other people who've been telling me that the people running the business are basically idiots and fools, and which seems to have been borne out by the fact that they couldn't even get the company to trade above, the New York Stock Exchange has various rules about how much you're supposed to trade and the value of your shares. And at this point, the New York Stock Exchange has halted Violin Memory trading because it actually has a zero value.
Wow.
It's still in business. It's still trading. But the share prices are effectively below $1 million. And therefore, there's no point in trading it. The New York Stock Exchange isn't worth trading it for.
That's going to be hard because SSDs, flash storage, has been, you know, such a hot market.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine that you could lose. There has to be a shakeout in the storage market at some time. But with everybody else still, you know, boosting along, it seems hard to imagine that this company could go out of business.
You also found out Fortinet, that they had quarterly news.
All right, I'll run through these really quickly because it's just tedious. Fortinet came in, beats the market by 3 cents per share, and they also came up on revenue. Shares are down, though. Over the last month overall because security stock stocks are starting to be more realistic. So if you go and check out the announcements from most of the other security companies, Imperva, Checkpoint, you'll see that security stocks are sort of, after a big drop about a month ago, not in great shape. So no big deal. Interestingly, Fortinet is doing $316 million in revenue a quarter. So that's quite substantial business. Mm-hmm. A10 Networks, again, total revenue for them grew $50 to $55 million. That's up 8%. When compared with the third quarter last year. So one thing I particularly noticed was that their services revenue, their Q3 services revenue, that is the revenue in the last quarter compared to the revenue a year ago, went from 15.7 to 19.7 million. So A10 Networks is growing strongly on the back of services revenue or recurring software licenses. I would hesitate to scuttlebutt that probably what they're seeing there is a sale of software licensing, especially to public cloud providers for DDoS appliances, is my guess.
Could be.
Gigamon reported their 3Q results. I've been fairly negative on Gigamon over time, and so they're kicking dirt in my face by announcing a quarterly revenue of $83.5 million, which is up 47% from this time last year, so year over year. So
that's a lot of dirt.
Oh, they were in real trouble a year ago. They really were struggling for sales. They couldn't find growth, and there's been a real shakeup in the executive team, and all of a sudden they've managed to add basically $30 million in sales in this quarter. That's pretty amazing. So, and they also increased profits marginally as well. So they didn't do it by discounting. They actually grew the profit margin by a few percentage points. So that's a huge turnaround. Great news for them. F5 Networks continues to beat the market. Revenue of $500 million, up 5% year over year. Beats the market by $5 million, which is basically petty cash on $500 million. Shares are up 4.5% because the market wants something to believe in. Basically, there's no reason for F5 Networks not to continue being successful, is what I think the markets see. They've got new products just coming onto stream to replace the previous generation. They've given up on, you know, I think the Cisco Ace sales boost that they got is pretty much run its course. And so we'll probably start to see F5 Networks steady as she goes. I think, you know, the fact that companies like A10 Networks and Riverbed are getting into load balancing and so forth is probably going to come in sometime in the future as people start to look for alternatives. So just for scale, A10 Networks is 1/10 the size of the F5 Networks business.
Right.
which is interesting. And the final one to draw to your attention is that Ericsson's CEO, you remember we did a piece about 6 to 8 weeks ago where Ericsson had a shocking quarter, had massive problems with their financial results, and then booted the CEO out the door. Well, the new CEO has said cost-cutting is the way to success. Oof. That always works. No, I think he's right. They've got to do a lot of refocusing. They're talking about headcount reductions around the world, but particularly in Switzerland. They do have to turn around their business. As I've said before, the general consensus is that Ericsson is under threat from ZTE and Huawei, who were both eating their lunch, in, yep. especially in the European markets and the Asian markets, where previously Ericsson and Nokia was very strong. Of course, there's no end to that because ZTE and Huawei have a 50-year strategy and Ericsson's got a 1 to 2 year strategy at best. So it's going
to
be tough.
A 1 to 2 quarter strategy.
Yeah, I think so. We'll see. So he's hoping Ericsson can find a way to keep up with the competition.
All right. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Network Break. Greg, if folks want to get more from you, how can they find you?
You can find me on the Twitter, is that Ethereal Mind? I'm also on Facebook and LinkedIn. You can find me as Ethereal Mind there and Greg Farrow on LinkedIn. And I'll be blogging more this week at packetpushers.net.
All right. I'm Drew Conroy Murray. I am on Twitter at Drew_CM, and I also blog at packetpushers.net. Thanks to our sponsors, IT Pro TV and Nuage Networks, and thank you for joining us for this episode of Network Break. If you like the show, give us a like on Facebook, leave a recommendation on iTunes, or share a link with your colleagues. And please check out our newsletters, Human Infrastructure Magazine and Link Propagation. You can find out how to sign up at packetpushers.net. And thanks for listening.